in terms of the number of cases that we will see in Alaska, it's very difficult to predict.
Preparing for swine flu during school season. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 20th of August. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, tracking sandhill cranes in Ketchumak Bay.
They dance, they hunt, they preen, they sleep.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alaska Communications Systems, converging voice, video, internet, and data applications for business. ACS connects companies from the North Slope to Ketchikan to each other and the rest of the world.
As the school year begins, the state is asking parents and teachers to take steps to guard against the spread of H1N1 flu virus. The Department of Health has issued 6 recommendations to schools, including making sure children stay home when they're sick and routine cleaning of areas frequented by students and staff. Dr. Joe McLaughlin is the state epidemiologist. He says people between the ages of 5 and 24 appear to be at increased risk for contracting this strain of flu.
In fact, half of all novel H1N1 flu cases that have been reported to CDC have occurred in persons in this age group, persons aged 5 to 24 years. So we expect that that trend will likely continue. And in terms of the number of cases that we will see in Alaska, it's very difficult to predict. What we've seen in the southern hemisphere, which is currently sort of still in their peak seasonal influenza season, is that the H1N1 virus has been the predominant strain that has been circulating. And we are speculating that the H1N1 virus will be the predominant strain circulating during our flu season this year as well. The thing that we know about the H1N1 virus is that it doesn't appear at this point to be any more severe than seasonal influenza.
What kinds of concerns are you hearing from principals, teachers, and parents?
I think the biggest concerns that we're hearing from folks revolve around what's going to happen this coming school season in terms of numbers of cases and severity of illness. That's the big unknown. People don't know how this particular virus is going to act this year. And we will be trying to get information out to the public and to healthcare providers as quickly as possible as we learn more from CDC and the World Health Organization. But that, I think, is the biggest concern. And then other concerns that parents have is, you know, if their child has to stay home, you know, that can often be difficult. They'll have to stay home from work and just sort of trying to manage that. I think that's a big concern that I'm hearing.
How is work on the H1N1 flu vaccine coming?
Well, work is coming along steadily. The last report that I had is that we are still expecting to get H1N1 flu vaccine by mid-October. The clinical trials on this particular vaccine are currently still ongoing, and these clinical trials are meant to evaluate both the efficacy of the vaccine as well as the safety of the vaccine. And we are anxiously awaiting the results of these studies.
And how much will the vaccine help?
We're hoping if it's anything like seasonal influenza vaccine, it is highly effective in preventing infection. One of the things that we are expecting, although it's not set in stone yet, is that this H1N1 vaccine will likely require 2 shots instead of just one, two immunizations instead of just one. So the first one would be administered, and then likely the second one would be administered about 3 weeks later. We don't know. It could be 2 weeks. It could be 4 weeks. It could be a little bit more, a little bit less.
Dr. Joe McLaughlin is Alaska's state epidemiologist. For a complete list of recommendations regarding H1N1 flu, you can find a link on our website, aprn.org. For people who believe they could qualify for state assistance under the state's Seniors and Disabilities Services have filed what they hope will become a class action lawsuit to force the program to begin accepting new applications. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services in June suspended the state's authority to process new applications or to reassess the needs of its existing clients because of an overload of uninvestigated requests. The action filed in federal court on Monday charges that the U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services, Kathleen Sebelius, overstepped her authority in ordering the suspension. The plaintiffs asked the federal district court to issue a restraining order against the federal and state governments, in effect ordering the program to reopen its enrollment process. A federal suspension on the Personal Care Assistance Service delivered by the same state agency was reinstated 2 weeks ago after the state hired more staff to work through the backlog of applications. The lawsuit targets the Medicaid waiver program. State officials are currently addressing problems uncovered in a federal review of that program. Neither the plaintiff's attorneys nor the state responded to requests for further information. The U.S. Department of Energy recently announced the award of a $1.1 million grant for a small hydroelectric project on Prince of Wales Island. As KRBD's Deanna Garrison reports, owners of the Reynolds Creek project are hoping to begin construction in 2010, although they have yet to secure all the necessary funding for the project.
U.S. Energy Secretary Stephen Chu this month announced $13.6 million in funding for new clean energy projects on tribal lands, including $1.1 million for Reynolds Creek. The 5-megawatt project is owned by Haida Power, a joint venture between Haida Corp and Alaska Power and Telephone. Haida Corp President Lisa Lang says her company hopes the hydroelectric project will help to develop the Prince of Wales Island economy.
There's many opportunities that energy could bring, but I'll tell you one thing. If you miss the opportunity to provide the energy at a low cost or even to provide it at all, you will not be able to sustain economic development. And really, I think Haida Corporation is looking at economic development and business development also.
Lang says the Reynolds Creek project would be tied into the main power grid on Prince of Wales, which is currently fed by two hydroelectric projects and supplemented by more expensive diesel power. She says more hydroelectric power is needed on Prince of Wales.
For the past summer, I think past 2 years, they've had to run on diesel, even though they have these two hydro projects on the northern end of the island. And one of the differences is that our project is at a lower elevation, and one of the benefits for us is that we would more than likely be not frozen up and unable to provide power. Or when there's surpluses on the island, for example, in the summer, there's a cold surge that just opened in Craig, and we would like to be able to provide power to that. Any kind of projects that are coming online, any kind of building and developing, we would be able to meet those needs.
The run-of-river hydroelectric project would be constructed on Reynolds Creek, about 10 miles east of Heidelberg near Copper Mountain. Lang says HydroCorp has spent nearly $3 million on the Reynolds Creek project. With the Department of Energy money, Haida Power has secured just over $4 million in federal and state grants for the project. But Lang says the project is estimated to cost between $16 and $17 million. Lang says Haida Power will continue to pursue grants, but is also looking at other financing options.
At this point, what Haida Corporation and AP&T are looking out to do is to move forward on finding either a low interest or a zero interest loan so that we can go to construction.
Lang says a Federal Energy Regulatory Commission permit requires Haida Power to begin construction on the project no later than October of 2010.
We have to have a shovel in the ground ready to go by that day, and that's a very tall order because the FERC requires a lot of things. We need to have a financial plan. We have to have a lot of our ducks in order, and that's what we've been working on so diligently to work towards the actual date that we go to construction.
Anticipated to be 20 feet long and 6 feet high, Reynolds Creek is considered a small hydroelectric project. In Ketchikan, I'm Deanna Garrison.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, restoring an old logging area near Sitka.
The easiest place to drive the logging equipment was to use the streams as the roads because it was quicker, it was cheaper.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
A 40-year-old clear cut along the Sitka Road system is undergoing extensive thinning this summer. The effort to cut and harvest second-growth timber in the Stargavin Valley is being funded in part by a consortium of conservation groups led by the National Sport Fishing Advocacy Organization Trout Unlimited. KCAW's Robert Woolsey met recently with representatives of the U.S. Forest Service and Trout Unlimited to talk about this unusual partnership.
The first thing you need to know about habitat restoration in Southeast Alaska is that the first few decades of industrial-scale logging often occurred in riparian areas, 1 to 200 feet or a tree length on either side of a stream bottom.
They're really important for fish production. They're also really important for vegetation, deer, bear. All life seems to really focus around those riparian areas.
That's Perry Edwards, a fisheries biologist with the Sitka Ranger District. The 739-acre timber unit in the Stargavin Valley was harvested in the late 1960s, before the Tongass Timber Reform Act in 1990 banned some logging practices that were found to be harmful, and to contemporary ears sound almost unbelievable.
The easiest place to drive the logging equipment was to use the streams as the roads, because it was quicker, it was cheaper, and so they drove straight up and down those, and they straightened those streams out, and they broke down the banks, and they removed any kind of large wood that was in there that helps to provide that fish habitat.
Edwards says other misguided ideas also contributed to the deterioration of riparian areas, namely a practice known as stream cleaning, where large woody debris was removed from the water after logging. Biologists have since learned that large wood is critical to fish habitat, forming pools for juvenile fish and controlling stream flow in high water events.
You've got to take care of the entire watershed.
Mark Kelke is the Southeast Projects Director for Trout Unlimited.
And have the interplay of the different functions working together to really make the best fish habitats. So looking at a watershed holistically instead of just at fish is what we're trying to do.
Trout Unlimited solicited contributions from other conservation groups, including the Wilberforce Foundation, the National Resource Conservation Service, and the National Forest Foundation, and used the money to contract with two professional forest thinners who have spent the summer working in the valley. Trout Unlimited has been involved in Southeast restoration projects for the last 4 years. Habitat restoration has been the centerpiece of Trout Unlimited's national agenda for the last 50 years. Kelke says the thinning in Stargavin this summer was not a one-shot deal.
We'll definitely keep working on it until we get the habitat back in a situation where it's productive again. For us, one of the reasons we were especially interested in being involved in Stargavin is that it's a very accessible place, and we can get people out there to see what's going on, and hopefully that's going to encourage more funding and more interest in doing the same kind of thing in other watersheds throughout the region.
Last year, the Forest Service collaborated with the University of Alaska to build two log cabins out of Stargavin second growth. The first was put in the Stargavin campground. The other was shipped to Wrangell. The byproduct this time around is firewood. Not many of the trees are cabin-sized, but there is plenty of smaller stuff that the Forest Service says is free for the taking. This is a departure from some thinning techniques like girdling, where trees are left to rot where they fall. While not a full-fledged biomass project yet, Forest Service biologist Perry Edwards says removing the thin trees for firewood will jumpstart the restoration of the Stargavin watershed.
The main driver behind doing this thinning work is to improve wildlife habitat, specifically deer winter habitat, try to open that up, try to get those the light to the understory so that we can get more food that deer use in the wintertime. So you have bunchberry, you have blueberry, you have foam flower, you have a number of other species of plants that are really critical for deer. And when those second growth stands really close in, it just becomes a desert. It's dark. There's nothing on the ground. You open that up to light. The remaining trees that are in there are going to grow faster and get you moving back towards that productive old growth at a much faster rate than if we just left it to natural succession.
Firewood gathering permits in Stargavin are free to the public. They're available at the district headquarters in Sitka. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
The most endangered run of Pacific salmon is beating the odds this summer. You can't get any closer to extinction than Snake River sockeye salmon did last decade. This is the Pacific Northwest run that gave us Lonesome Larry, so named because he was the one and only sockeye to complete the migration in 1992. Northwest News correspondent Tom Bonsi reports Lonesome Larry's descendants are coming back this year by the hundreds.
Snake River sockeye are currently performing an incredible feat of migration. They swim upriver for 900 miles. Their route to the spawning grounds in central Idaho crosses 8 hydropower dams. The fish climb to an elevation of about 6,500 feet at their destination, Redfish Lake. Idaho Fish and Game's Dan Baker waits there beside a fish trap.
They were about just over a month from spawning, so they're really getting that the reddish color to them, the bright red color.
These salmon are so precious, Baker and his colleagues trap every single returnee. They hold the sockeye in protective custody at a hatchery until it's time to spawn next month.
Most of these fish so far have been four-year-old fish. They're running about 3.5 pounds.
Word of the bumper run of rare fish is getting around. The daily emptying of a trap on the upper Salmon River draws a crowd. Vacationer Anthony Winget of Sand Hollow, Idaho, says it's great to see progress in fixing the damage he says humans caused by building dams downriver.
We are very lucky, yeah, that they came back. I mean, it's called redfish here, too, for a reason. I mean, not just because there's a couple of trout in there, it's because it used to be color of red, and you don't see that anymore up here.
Sport fisherman Chancey Butters of Preston, Idaho, hopes the years when just a handful of sockeye returned are over, but...
Well, I think they're far away from where they used to be, and I don't know if they'll ever get back there, but they're trying. Now they've got hundreds coming back, so hopefully in 10 years there's thousands.
Threatened Chinook salmon are also coming back in numbers not seen since the dams on the lower Snake River were completed in 1975.
Now, everything's sort of lined up the last 2 years to really get these good returns, and it's helped all the salmon.
Idaho Fish and Game's Dan Baker explains his agency has greatly ramped up hatchery production of endangered sockeye. Bonneville Power is paying the bills, along with other projects.
They've made modifications to the dams to help passage of smolts going down. We've had some good water years. That always helps. I mean, you can't beat a good flush of water going out to the ocean.
These fish also benefited from a federal judge's order for higher flows and more water spilled over the tops of dams to improve survival. And they must have found plentiful food in the ocean.
Then again, as the adults are coming back, we've had good migration conditions and a little bit cooler waters.
Baker says we're still a long ways from being out of the woods with these endangered salmon. Those are almost the exact same words used by Bill Sedevy, the director of the environmental group Idaho Rivers United.
We're hopeful that it's an indicator that we're not going to lose this just incredible species, this incredible marvel of nature forever.
But to achieve what it calls harvestable, self-sustaining levels, Sedevy argues Snake River dams have to go.
We're still close to the brink. We haven't gone far enough yet. The lower Snake River is still too far removed from being a natural river.
Dam removal remains hugely controversial, as it has for more than a decade. The Bonneville Power Administration points to this year's banner returns as evidence that modifications at the dams, short of breaching, are moving things in the right direction. All sides are waiting in suspense to hear how the Obama administration will weigh in on Columbia and Snake River Dam operations and water flows. Court filings expected next month may provide some clarity on that. I'm Tom Bonsley near Stanley, Idaho.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
Legislators are heading back out across the state to listen to the public's ideas about satisfying local energy needs. Two Senate committees, Resources and Energy, and the House Committee Energy Committee will begin a series of late summer tours in Dutch Harbor next Wednesday. House Energy Co-Chair Bryce Edgman says his committee will next go to Haines in September to hear from members of the Southeast Conference that will be meeting at the same time. However, Edgman says the public will be encouraged to take part in all the sessions.
It's more of a learning opportunity for us as policymakers to go into somebody's backyard and to hear certainly about the local needs, the local challenges, what people are doing in terms of innovation to combat high energy prices. Certainly anytime you go to somebody's town, you want to hear from them about their local concerns, and that exactly, you know, is what we intend to do.
So far this year, his committee has visited with people in Kotzebue, Noatak, Nome, Bethel, Dillingham, and Fairbanks. The Senate Resources and Energy Committees will begin their fall hearings in Kodiak on September 1st. Resources co-chair Bill Wilikowski has scheduled hearings to include more regional input from the public. Wilikowski says there is no single solution to the state's needs.
You've got the Southeast, which has a huge abundance of hydro energy, and has really done a fantastic job of tapping into that. But they still have issues nonetheless. We've got the Rail Belt, which has its own issues with natural gas. It's certainly in the Anchorage area in South Central, but also when you get the Fairbanks, they have their own issues. So, and then you've got the rural communities, which is really a completely separate type of issues than the Rail Belt or Southeast. And so we're looking at really three different plans and three different completely separate ways of approaching the energy concerns that people have all throughout the state.
Wilikowski says he won't promise to have a complete and comprehensive energy plan ready for consideration during next year's legislative session, but he hopes the state will have taken several steps forward in developing a plan by then. A sure sign of fall. Sandhill cranes are stopping in Fairbanks on their migration south. The birds are congregating at the Creamers Field Migratory Waterfowl Refuge. Alaska Bird Observatory senior scientist Susan Sharbaugh says they seem to be arriving earlier than normal.
We've had hundreds of cranes on the fields here at Creamers for the last 10 days or so. So to me, it seems that they're running a little bit early.
Sharbaugh says most of the cranes passing through Fairbanks spent the summer nesting in northern and western Alaska. Creamers Field is a regular stopover site, and the State Department of Fish and Game grows grain there to feed migrating birds. Sharbaugh says the cranes aren't the only birds that have been arriving early, and it's unclear what that means.
Migration in general is driven, first of all, by photoperiod, the decrease in light. And on top of that first signal, there are other signals as far as just the weather patterns and also their physiological condition, how fast they're fattening and if they're ready to make that journey. So whether it was the dry weather in July or the smoke or insect availability, we're not quite sure.
Sharbaugh says there's no direct correlation between early migration and the onset of winter. She says the cranes may stay in Fairbanks longer and still depart as normal in early September. Large Vs of cranes are visible in the sky right now, and you can hear the birds' distinctive calls. Sharbaugh says the calls are an important communication tool during migration.
A lot of the noise is contact calls among the cranes. They're just keeping track of one another. The family groups migrate south together, so the adults are teaching the youngsters what the paths are for migration, and they're just getting ready for the next part of their journey.
The sandhill cranes will cover thousands of miles, traveling from their summer breeding grounds in Alaska to wintering areas in Texas and New Mexico. For the past decade, one Homer couple has been dedicated to tracking the habits and movements of sandhill cranes that migrate to the Kachemak Bay area in the spring and summer. KBBI's Marsha Lynn recently visited their secluded refuge to view the birds up close and has this story.
Inspiration Ridge Preserve is the name Nina Faust and Ed Bailey have given to this vast spread of rolling green fields that cascades down from their Skyline Ridge home. A panoramic view of Kachemak Bay with mountains and glaciers in the distance completes the scene. About 30 cranes wander around near the house, bobbing their long necks and pecking at corn. Occasionally, a crane will stretch its wings to show its 73-inch wingspan. Faust says she never tires of watching the cranes.
They dance, they hunt, they preen, they sleep. They're on alert looking for predators. It's just a whole beautiful picture of their lives as they wander around getting food and relaxing and enjoying the area.
But this year, the number of returning cranes is lower. Bailey, a retired wildlife biologist, believes that's because more eagles in the area are preying upon the cranes.
Pretty bleak right now for this year, unless the ones that used to be here have largely, like I suspect, moved up in the more interior areas and further north. Because the bald eagles tend to want to be in areas where near water, big like streams, lakes, the ocean, of course. But you get away from the coastal areas and they thin out, that as far as the eagle numbers.
He feels strongly that years of feeding the eagles has brought an overabundance of eagles to the area and kept away the cranes.
Obviously, as a biologist, and just from the emotional standpoint, I'm just thrilled to be around them. And I guess that's why I'm taking it so hard when you have fed predators, you know, eliminate them or get them in a situation where they're very nervous where they normally wouldn't be, which is often the case now.
CatchMac Crane Watch is the vehicle by which Faust and Bailey keep track of the cranes' annual migration route. They solicit help, asking people to call in crane sightings. Faust says there's a great response.
We are not the only craniacs in this town. There are lots of people that revere cranes and are just ecstatic when they get a chance to see them. They'll call us up, when are the cranes going to arrive? And then, of course, we get calls of, I saw my first crane today. He was flying right over and I think he landed down at the slough.
We're listening to the receiver from a radio tracking device worn by cranes with bands on their long, skinny legs.
So number 40 is just right outside the window. And what's nice is that this device that goes on the car, it actually is a stronger antenna, so we can pick up a bird that may be a little bit further away than this. And a lot further.
They began radio tracking last spring in conjunction with a federally sponsored satellite project that tracks the crane migration route from California to Alaska. Data from the satellite tracking project is posted on the internet so people can follow where the birds are in their travels. Faust says information from radio tracking is localized. It helps show crane habitat and where they nest. But she emphasizes the importance of input from the public.
The pairs, when they're nesting, are generally very secretive, and it's pretty hard to find them. You can't just drive around and find them. It doesn't happen that way. In fact, some of the people that watch their families, they don't even know where they nest. They just suddenly appear in their yard. So to get the information about how much recruitment is occurring for the local flock, we need to have people call us and let us know.
In Homer, I'm Marsha Lynn.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Deanna Garrison in Ketchikan, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, Tom Bonsi in Idaho, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Marsha Lynn in Homer. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Penn Air, operating since 1955 and providing 9 destinations with service to 36 communities throughout Southwest Alaska. Reservations and rates online at penair.com.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.